dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
Sun Welcome guests, I'm Lynn Gary. During the presidential debate between McCain and Obama last week, the candidates were asked whether health care was a right or a responsibility. McCain said responsibility. Obama said right. But does that question make sense? How can you exercise a responsibility without rights, without power? Making that point is central to the thesis of the book Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, which I've been reading you weekly. The present chapter on blaming the victim has great relevance to the discourse about the present financial crisis. Various parties are arguing about how to solve the financial crisis. The leaders of capitalism are meeting this weekend. The unchallenged assumption is that the system, capitalism, should be saved. I think that question should be part of the discourse. So I'm going to begin the program with a really long rant so I can, to paraphrase Naomi Klein, leave some ideas lying around. The financial crisis and the $700 billion bailout have more people than usual asking questions such as, how did such a mess occur? Why didn't we have a clue? And how come our alleged representatives ignored our demands to reject a bailout of Wall Street bankers, who then treated themselves to fancy spas and bonuses on our tab, when most of us are having increasing difficulty in affording food, shelter, and other necessities? Susan Rosenthal asserts that blaming the victim, such as the rhetoric of personal responsibility, is a strategy by the ruling class to deflect attention from the way it systematically benefits and the rest of us suffer from the social inequality that is the basis of capitalism. It was her own sense of powerlessness as a physician and psychotherapist to address the primary causes of ill health, the constant stress and anxiety of making a livelihood in an environment of cutthroat competition and toxic pollutants, neither of which an individual has the power to change, even if they have taken personal responsibility to become an activist to try to change those things. There's ample evidence that our bodies and minds can't function properly, nor are we happy, in a state of constant anxiety, exhaustion, and poison. A website called Market Crash describes the capitalist market as follows, quote, "In financial markets, the majority is always wrong. When the investing majority or the crowd is overly bearish, this is the best time to be buying stocks. When the crowd is overly exuberant, this is the time to be selling stocks. The financial markets work in this ironic way because not everyone can win in the market. If it were possible for everyone to win in the markets, this would mean that money is being created from nothing. The creation of money in this manner is impossible. Therefore, the markets are a zero-sum game. Zero-sum means that for every winner, there is a loser. The winner takes the loser's money. Zero-sum games are games where the amount of winnable goods is fixed." Close quote. What's the impact of such a system on losers in a society where money is needed to obtain even the most basic necessities, where losing is not a game, but a real life and death matter? I think that anyone who advocates such a system has no call to lecture others on morality, but they do. Blaming the victim has been a prominent theme in the mainstream discourse surrounding the so-called subprime crisis. Example, all those people who shouldn't have bought homes they couldn't afford. One might ask, why weren't there any homes they could afford? The price of homes had doubled and tripled in price in some places in just a few years' time. I mean the same home. What is the relationship of price to value when the house at 123 Main Street costs $100,000 in 2003 and $200,000 in 2005? Others have asked why bankers made loans to people without the means to pay them back. Bankers are in the business of making loans and charging interest. In order to increase their profits, which shareholders demand, they must either charge higher interest rates or make more loans. Either way, at some point, they'll run out of affluent borrowers, especially in an environment where prices are rising while wages are, in real terms, falling. The bankers thought they'd found a way to pass their risks on to someone else with the help of Wall Street mathematicians and see-no-evil rating agencies. We have heard politician after pundit say that banking and credit are essential to our economy and must be saved by any means necessary. Isn't it time to ask whether we need a different sort of economy? It seems to me that for some people, capitalism is like a religion. Its failures are not attributed to its essential flaws, but the failure by people to practice it with sufficient devotion and purity. Such devotees say the government has intervened to pervert the functioning of free markets through manipulation of currency and interest rates via central bank policies, government subsidies, burdensome regulations that interfere with business, and taxation that robs deserving people of the fruits of their labors and redistributes it in various unworthy ways, some of which lead to moral decay by discouraging personal responsibility, etc. Many of these same people are rightly outraged by the corruption within the financial world so prominently on display right now. They correctly but ironically wonder why the regulators failed to put a stop to it, especially when the financial chicanery has damaged their own investments. If markets are dominated by crooks, even with regulation, what would they look like without it? Even more crooks. That's why regulations were instituted. Success in markets is based on cheating others. Buying something for less than it's worth, selling it to someone else for more than it's worth, finding the greater fool. Here's what Investopedia says about the greater fool theory. Quote, a theory that states that it's possible to make money by buying securities, whether overvalued or not, and later selling them at a profit, because there will always be someone, a bigger or greater fool, who is willing to pay the higher price. When acting in accordance with the greater fool theory, an investor buys questionable securities without any regard to their quality, but with the hope of selling them off quickly to another investor, the greater fool, who might also be hoping to flip it quickly. Unfortunately, speculative bubbles always burst eventually, leading to a rapid depreciation in share price due to the sell-off. Close quote. I have heard commentators of the true believer sort assert that it's bad people, not capitalism, that are to blame. Well, I agree that there are bad people, and people who act badly. And I have to ask the question, why are there so many bad people concentrated in one occupation? Social science researchers have found that sociopaths, people without the ability to empathize with others, tend to rise to high positions within corporations because corporate success depends upon the ability to focus on the profitability of the company, irrespective of the harm caused to others. A corporate leader must be ready to dump thousands onto the unemployment line or toxic chemicals into the lake, to make dangerous products and lie about it if that provides the best cost-benefit ratio, and smash a potential competitor whose products would not only be more socially beneficial, but more popular with consumers. The latter, by the way, happens quite often. Inventors' ideas are bought, then buried by corporations who consider them a threat to their existing business model. The inventor walks away rich, but society is denied the benefit of the innovation. Patents and so-called intellectual property laws prevent anyone else from putting the useful invention into production. Yet it is claimed that these laws are necessary to encourage innovation and therefore socially beneficial. More on that later. It's hardly surprising that sociopathic executives would ultimately rip off their own shareholders or the taxpayers who bail them out. People prepared to win a zero-sum game are people prepared to hurt others. Not all corporate executives are sociopaths, of course, and some are driven by their consciences to become philanthropists. Capitalism forces people to choose between being the victim or the victimizer, winner or loser. And not just corporate executives, all of us. If you apply for a job, you will only get it at the expense of the other applicants who won't have a job, even though they needed the job as much as you did. You, being your average decent person, had no intent to harm any of the other job seekers. Somebody put you in a zero-sum game. Did anyone ever ask you if that's what you wanted? I know they didn't, because I grew up in the same society you did. They told us there was no alternative, or that this was freedom, or else they told you that if you wanted the government to give you a job, go back to the Soviet Union. Perhaps they told you it's natural law, the law of the jungle, wolves eat sheep, and so on. The problem with that argument is we're not wolves and sheep. We're either all wolves or all sheep. In other words, the same species. Wolves don't eat wolves, and sheep don't eat sheep, and people have a choice as to how we want to conduct our society. In fact, we're all relatives and can trace our descent to a common ancestor, a woman who lived about 150,000 years ago in Africa. And as a matter of fact, we have a common ancestor with wolves and sheep. Much, much further back, of course. Native Americans have acknowledged this kinship for millennia, and modern science has recently confirmed the truth of it. Our families are not based on buying and selling to one another. We don't charge our sister interest when she borrows the toolbox. We expect her to lend us the lawnmower. We don't demand payment from our son to live at our house. We expect him to help with the chores. Why don't we extend these family values to our extended family instead of playing a zero-sum game? One might ask, wouldn't that be really hard to make work? Sure, but what we have now clearly doesn't work too well either. Doesn't it make more sense to put all that effort into playing a win-win game rather than one, no matter how much effort you put into it? Will result in losers because it's set up as a zero-sum game? Much is made of the intelligence of the human species when claiming our superiority and right to exploit other species. Yet when it comes to making decisions about how our society should function, we're suddenly considered too stupid. It is for sure that a lot of people are clueless, ignorant. That is because most of what we are told is a lie, or spin, and the truth is classified or proprietary information. Garbage in, garbage out. Economists and financial commentators have been discussing whether the real estate bubble is comparable to the dot-com bubble of 2000, whether the banking crisis is like the Asia banking crisis of the 90s or the savings and loan crisis of the 80s, whether we will have a stagflation crisis like the 70s or a depression like the 30s, whether J.P. Morgan's role is similar to that in the crisis of 1907. It has even been compared to the South Sea bubble of the 18th century. The point is that capitalism moves from crisis to crisis, each time doing great harm, usually to the people that benefited least from its boom times. One definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. If the shed you built collapsed when you slammed the door, you'd be looking to make some design changes, wouldn't you? Capitalism can't do what its advocates claim it can, bring universal prosperity and liberty. You can see that from history. But you could predict what has happened for the past several hundred years just by knowing that it's a zero-sum game. Americans who've grown up during and since the Cold War have been indoctrinated to equate capitalism with democracy and told that its alternative is a centrally planned gulag state where everyone wears uniformly ugly clothes. Not only are there other alternatives to those, the reality is that capitalists actually don't like democracy. Speaking of wolves and sheep, the hosts of a popular financial podcast recently described democracy as two wolves and a sheep deciding what to have for dinner. I take their point in that one does not want to live in a society where a majority can mistreat a minority. But capitalism is a system in which one wolf eats three sheep for dinner and doesn't ask their opinion because he has laws made by other wolves on his side. It's a society in which a rich, powerful minority's individual rights take precedent over all others' individual rights. I really like individual rights. I want the same ones as a billionaire or a corporation. How about you? For example, what about the individual rights of people who don't want a 5,000-hog factory farm, toxic waste incinerator, nuclear power plant, or other such thing put in their community? They are told the corporation has an individual right, a property right to put it there. Objectors are derided as NIMBYs. What if there was a law requiring the corporate management of a factory farm or oil refinery to live within 100 yards of their facility? NIMBY would be declared a new religion. I have reported extensively on this show about the mostly conservative Republican people in rural Pennsylvania who discovered they lived in a capitalist society, not a democratic one. Big difference. When they tried to stop factory farms and toxic sludge dumpers from invading their communities. And I bet they even wore flag lapel pins for all the good that did them. What did them good was banding together and resisting. By the way, they got screwed by the Democrats as well as the Republicans. What they learned was, it's never too soon to rebel. All sarcasm aside, there is a real problem with the infrastructure of an industrial society. It is often toxic, noisy, and ugly. Who decides what technologies should be introduced and how they should be implemented? Who defines progress, the common good? Why don't our so-called individual rights include informed consent to the introduction of technologies and activities that affect all of us? I'd much rather have that than the right to fail, which I recently heard a celebrity financial analyst declare was a right under capitalism. The factory farm will claim they're just meeting the demand for cheap bacon. And the sludge dumpers, who are in league with federal and state environmental regulators, will claim they're just trying to solve the problem of waste disposal. There are many ways to tackle these problems, but a small group makes a decision and then presents us with a fait accompli. We are never presented with a range of alternatives and allowed to come to consensus based on their strengths and weaknesses. This would involve presenting complete and truthful information, something that doesn't happen because full disclosure and profits don't mix. Greater fool, zero-sum game. Let's take food. People can get cheaper and better food by cooperatively supporting local family farmers through CSAs, a process that also reduces toxics and greenhouse gases. But the real estate industry and the U.S. Department of Agriculture have collaborated for years to drive out the small farms that used to surround every city and replace them with suburbia. In the reading of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of Education, I reported his findings of how the decision to centralize the food supply into the hands of giant agribusiness corporations was made in Washington, and school taxes were used to make it impossible for the farmers to remain on their land, causing them to sell out to real estate developers. This was justified in the name of efficiency, economies of scale, and better schools. But the schools didn't become better if you define better as producing smarter, more literate students. Just the opposite. Literacy has demonstrably declined. The hours of school did get longer, and the students got stupider. I went to those schools, and I was taught very little of value to me. But they tried to teach me something that was of value to someone else. To stand, sit, and walk at the sound of a bell like Pavlov's dog. To memorize and regurgitate without question what was told to me by an authority figure in order to get a good grade. To rank myself in relation to others and compete with them for approval from authority. To obey rules for which no rational justification was given, and to comply with this even if you didn't believe in it or face negative consequences. In my case, it didn't take too well because I was raised in a family that understood the value of disobedience. One side fled a fascist killing machine, the other conscription into a czar's army. They taught me that if anybody told me to do something, I had a right to demand a reason and decide if it was valid. This made for a tempestuous family life, and they might have regretted it. I wish I could thank them for that gift, now that I've lived long enough to understand it. Unfortunately, it's too late because they're dead. There is such a thing in life as being too late. Drill, baby, drill. To hell with the environment, right? Much has been made in the discourse of the financial crisis of the indebtedness of Americans, both personally and nationally. Why are Americans so indebted? Because credit is profitable for the corporate world on the whole. Since the 1970s, manufacturers faced declining profits, as the economic historian Robert Brenner's research has shown. To boost these profits, we saw waves of downsizing, then outsourcing. Then, with the help of government and cheerleaders in academia, the installation of the so-called free trade regimes, which, coupled with new technologies, made it possible for capital to move production to places where it could pay the least and pollute the most, thanks to dictators kept in place through the efforts of the military-industrial complex. A fatal flaw of capitalism is that it must gain profits through selling to people who have money to buy. If you are working on the one hand to put downward pressure on wages, what happens to your customer base? One business's customer who can't pay his bill is another business's downsized worker. And not only must you make profits, these profits must increase, or you will be eaten by a more profitable competitor. Profit can either be increased by consolidation, mergers, and monopoly, or by economic growth. Recessions go with the monopoly option, decreasing the number of capitalist competitors, but also the number of available jobs. Booms increase the amount and variety of economic activity, but run up against the finite nature of customers who can pay the price. Capitalists argue among themselves whether depressions are desirable or not, preventable or not. Let's ask, what if we had an economy whose goal was meeting needs rather than generating profits, because they're not the same? In the capitalist society, only people with money can meet their needs. They can meet them in direct proportion to how much money they have. People with little or no money have the same needs as people with money. They are just barred by law from meeting them. People who try to meet their needs without money tend to wind up behind bars. It is now in some places even illegal to forage in dumpsters. Government welfare programs, which are supposed to take up the slack, are designed to inflict the maximum humiliation. I have some friends that have recently had to go on food stamps for the first time in their lives. To determine their allotment, they had to fill out forms signed by their landlords documenting their amount of monthly rent, report whether they owned a car and its value, the value of their personal effects, such as their stereos, and so on. I question the woman who runs the agency that handles the food stamps for my county why people are put through this. The answer, of course, is that it was to prevent fraud against the taxpayers. What does that amount to anyway, that someone will be able to buy $25 or $50 or $100 more food a month than someone else has decided they're entitled to? You can only buy food from a grocery with food stamps. They can't be used to eat at five-star restaurants or fast food restaurants even. You can't use them to buy non-food items, not even toilet paper, toothpaste, or soap. According to an article in USA Today, many of the people who are turning to food pantries today are reporting that their food stamps aren't even lasting 2 weeks out of every month, says Lisa Hamler Fugit, executive director of the Ohio Association of Second Harvest Food Banks. Many people who are not recipients of food stamps have now noticed the different attitude toward protecting the taxpayers when it comes to impoverished citizens and Wall Street bankers. And more people than ever are now on food stamps. In the same article, one recent food stamp applicant was described as follows, quote, Philomena Gist understands why it hurts so much to be on food stamps. After all, she's got a master's degree in psychology. There's pride in being able to take care of yourself, says the Columbus, Ohio resident, laid off last year from a mortgage company and living on workers' compensation benefits while recovering from surgery. I'm not supposed to be in this condition, close quote. Who is supposed to be in that condition? In every financial crisis, it is money that is destroyed. Recessions and depressions are defined as a destruction of capital, the reduction of money. Philomena is hungry because she lacks money, not because of a shortage of food. There's piles of it rotting uneaten week in and week out. People become homeless because they lack money, not because there is a lack of homes. The homes stand empty and boarded up. Welfare programs like food stamps are often denounced as encouraging moral decay. Moral decay starts at the top, with the people that force upon us a system that glorifies cheating others in order to benefit, a zero-sum game. We have an insoluble financial crisis because capitalism has no win-win solutions to fix the problems it causes. Contrary to what they'd like you to think, there are many options for society other than a choice between a capitalist gulag and a Stalinist gulag. One prominent financial analyst who serves as an advisor to that bastion of liberty, Congressman Ron Paul, recently said on his radio show Wall Street Unspun that China is now a better example of a capitalist country than the U.S. I'm not sure if he realized what he was saying. A polluted police state run by an oligarchy is an exemplar of capitalist liberty? Hey, you Ron Paul fans, I know you listen. Is that what you had in mind? Listeners have written in the past saying they liked Ron Paul and asking me to cover his run for president. I do take requests on the program, but I didn't comply with that one. Reason number one, I support nobody for president. I don't support the office of president, which I see as serial monarchy. And I don't support Ron Paul, whose idea of liberty includes forcing me to have a baby against my will and then forcing me to pay the hospital bills on top of it. I don't care if he supports sound money over unsound money. I'm against money. I heard an interview with Ron Paul in which he pointed out that he's all for people getting rich. He gave Bill Gates as a fine example. Bill Gates has tried to have free software outlawed. For those unfamiliar with free software, thousands of computer programmers have collaborated without pay to produce software for everyone to use free of charge and to modify as their talents allow. This software is superior in quality to the software that Bill Gates makes lots of money selling. Free software, no profit, no money. Win-win. Bill Gates, Ron Paul's exemplar of capitalist success, wants to take away your ability to use a Firefox browser or a Linux operating system or make something nice and give it to the world, which is how we got agriculture, architecture, the wheel, and ice cream. Bill Gates is a convicted monopolist. Is that your idea of economic freedom? I appreciate that Ron Paul has spoken out against the war, though. The problem is, you can't be anti-war and support the right to be rich like Bill Gates. Rich people are the ones who start the wars, trying to keep and expand their riches through the conquest of land, people, and raw materials. Poor people don't start wars, they're just sent to fight in them. I recently heard an interview on the excellent podcast, Electric Politics, with a guest who was a longtime champion of nonviolence. The guy borders on sainthood. He's one of those radical priests that go to military installations and damage weapons and then do time in prison for it. He's made a study of Gandhi and written books on the subject. You get the idea. During his interview, he made the comment how important it was to eliminate poverty in order to end the causes for war. I've heard people say that many times and nodded, yeah, I want to end war, I want to end poverty. But then it occurred to me, poverty is not the cause of war. It is the result of war. Wealth is the cause of war, the goal of war. Speaking of which, I have a bone to pick with the host of that excellent show, George Kenney, which can be found, by the way, at electricpolitics.com. A year ago, I rebroadcast one of his outstanding interviews on the subject of authoritarianism on this show. Shortly afterward, I received a letter from Kenney threatening to sue me for stealing his material and ordering me to, quote, cease and desist. At that time, he had announced how happy he was that his podcast listenership had reached 1,000 people. I thought that was way too little for such an excellent program, and I paid him, I thought, the compliment of rebroadcasting his work. I credited him, of course, and gave his website URL, of course, and I assume an unwelcome guest listener must have contacted him, which is how he knew of it. Kenney is a former member of the U.S. Diplomatic Corps, and one of the best of them, as he resigned in protest over the bombing of Yugoslavia. His interviews are great because he's really smart and thinks deeply about the subjects he covers. If one of the best responds in this way, it's no surprise U.S. diplomacy is such a failure. I responded to his threatening letter with an apology for unintentionally upsetting him. I expected some sort of reply. I got none. Just a denunciation on a subsequent podcast about some mashup that aired his interview without permission. What is the problem? Lots of people rebroadcast this program without contacting me to ask for permission. If I didn't want people to hear it, I wouldn't give it away on the internet. This makes a great segue into one of capitalism's greatest injuries to humanity, the concept of intellectual property. Intellectual property not only injures the growth of knowledge and invention, though it claims to do the opposite, it's used to obfuscate the predatory nature of capitalism's concept of individual rights. The GMO issue is the perfect example of this. Biotech companies purport to be developing new things to benefit people. But what they're really engaged in is a project to privatize the right to innovate in agriculture and to gain monopoly control over farming. All of our thousands of domesticated food varieties were developed by millions of farmers over 10,000 years, making improvements, building on each other's knowledge, and sharing their seeds with everyone. The old-time analog of the Firefox browser. Massive benefit for humanity. Win, win. Big problem, not enough profit in that for capitalists. When people began to object to untested GMOs being put in our food supply and ecosystem, the industry mounted a PR campaign about golden rice. Golden rice was genetically engineered to contain increased amounts of vitamin A, which was supposed to help the children going blind in the third world from vitamin A deficiency. Capitalism has no solutions to the problems it causes. Vitamin A deficiency is not caused by the lack of the existence of foods containing ample vitamin A, or the non-existence of bottles of vitamin A pills. The deficiency causing the blindness of the children is caused by the tyranny of capitalism that deprives their parents of the money to buy foods or pills containing A, or the land to grow their own. If they cannot afford carrots, spinach, sweet potatoes, squash, or their local equivalent foods, what makes anyone think they could afford golden rice? They can't, but the U.S. government will buy the golden rice from the biotech companies with taxpayer money and foist it on the starving countries in the name of aid. I'm sorry to tell you that there's usually a hidden profit agenda behind every shipment of U.S. foreign aid. But won't eliminating intellectual property hurt the arts? Shakespeare is regarded as one of the greatest dramatists of all time, and Mozart one of the greatest composers. Lack of intellectual property laws did not prevent them from creating works of such power that they continue to be treasured centuries after their creator's death. Yeah, but didn't all those guys die in poverty? It's true that if Shakespeare or Mozart were alive today, they would benefit from the use of copyright in a system where all life is put into the context of a zero-sum game. The real problem is the failure of our culture to value and care for those who share their gifts with us, unless they can be successfully pimped by a corporation. The price you pay for the music you buy goes mostly to the record company, not the artists. I promise you, no creative genius who lives in a so-called primitive culture dies alone and destitute like so many of our artists, whose works make millions for others after they are dead. The problem of the mistreatment of our artists is indicative of a culture based on the mistreatment of everyone, zero-sum game. What's so bad about profit anyway? I think that many people confuse earnings with profits. Your paycheck is not profit. Profit is surplus value, the difference between the cost to produce a product and what it is sold for in the market. Which brings us to your paycheck. You're told that you are receiving a fair price for your efforts on behalf of your employer, because it is what the market will bear, and the genius of the market is to find the right price for everything. Something's not quite right here, so stay with me on this, okay? If a jacket is on sale for $100 and the cost to produce it was $50, what is the fair price? Either those who furnished the labor and materials got paid less than the value of what they provided, or the buyer is getting ripped off by paying $50 too much. Capitalism is screwed up because it sets price by scarcity, providing an incentive to withhold rather than give. A system based on common sense would place the highest value on what was most necessary. Clean water would always be worth more than a diamond, because the lack of clean water results in death. The lack of a diamond results in nothing. Capitalists justify profit by claiming that without the profit motive, no one would produce goods and services. How do they get anyone to believe this when almost every single person alive knows from personal experience this is false? Women have been feeding and clothing and teaching their children, keeping their houses and providing care for the sick and injured, not only without profit, but without pay. Humans will do what it takes to create what they need and want, always have, always will. Yeah, some might say, mothers can provide chicken soup, but what about open heart surgery? Many hospitals that provide heart surgery are non-profits. Every enterprise but one that now exists for profit could be run as a non-profit, with any surplus going back to higher wages for the workers, improvement of the facilities, or the reduction of the price of services. The one exception? Wall Street. Which makes an appropriate segue to the issue of Wall Street and its bailouts. As I write, the lords of capitalism are meeting to try to save the global banking system. I'll leave it to some other journalist to report the outcome. Last week on the program, I delivered warnings from various financial experts on the prospect of a bank holiday. I hope you took notice, because more than one knowledgeable analyst says that the problem has worsened over the past week and a bank shutdown is still likely. Another issue I mentioned last week was the specter of martial law. I later learned of a speech made on the floor of Congress on October 2nd, in which Representative Brad Sherman, a Democrat from California, reported that the prospect of martial law had been used to pressure some members of Congress into passing the bill. In addition to that, his speech contains a number of interesting points, and we're going to hear it now, courtesy of C-SPAN.
Policy of January 18, 2007, the gentleman from California, Mr. Sherman, is recognized for the remainder of the time.
I thank the chair. I've got 30 minutes, and I'll share some with the gentlelady from Ohio in just a second to describe the flaws with this bill. Believe it or not, 30 minutes is not long enough. But first, I want to mention about the calls that are coming into our office. You know, the calls used to be from people around the country. Now Wall Street firms have their employees unplugging those headsets to call investors and instead calling members of Congress. And so now the calls coming in to at least my office have shifted from 20-1 against this bailout package for Wall Street down to about 3 or 4-1 against this bailout. I ask my colleagues not to be confused. Edit out some of those calls that are coming to you from folks who are being paid to make the call, and you'll realize the country remains absolutely overwhelmingly opposed to this Wall Street bailout bill. I thank again the gentleman from Ohio, and I will make a few more points. We had a meeting of the Skeptics Caucus, which is now a bipartisan Skeptics Caucus, where we heard from Bill Isaac. Mr. Isaac was chair of the FDIC, having first been appointed to that board by President Carter and then appointed by Reagan. You don't find very many people who have support on both sides of the aisle like that. And Bill Isaac led the FDIC in solving the 1981 crisis, which was probably worse than the crisis that we have now. He used the emergency powers of the FDIC. He was able to solve that credit crisis without significant cost to the taxpayer. We ought to hear from Bill Isaac. And I look forward to us defeating this bill tomorrow so that we can have hearings. And all my colleagues, not just those who came to the Skeptics Caucus, can hear from Mr. Isaac and so many others. Because the starting point is this testimony that we didn't hear before any hearing, because there have been no hearings on this bill, but rather a letter sent to members of Congress by hundreds of eminent economists, including three Nobel laureates. And they said, we ask Congress not to hold appropriate hearings and to carefully consider the right course of action. So Nobel laureates, economists eminent in their field, say the sky will not fall if we take some time. The only way to pass this bill is to keep up the panic. The panic has to be calmed down. We've got a few days. We've got a week. We've got 10 days, and that's more than enough time to write a much better bill. But let me summarize some of the other things that Bill Isaac told our Skeptics Caucus. A vote no on tomorrow's bill is not a vote to do nothing. It's a vote to defeat that bill and to start writing a much better bill. Under the bill that comes before us tomorrow, in Mr. Isaac's belief, half of all the money is going to be used to bail out foreign investors who made dumb business decisions. Now, I'm not real sure that I want to use taxpayers' money to bail out American investors who made bad business decisions. But why are we bailing out the Bank of China? Why are we bailing out the Saudi royal family? We are doing so because they demand it. They communicate those demands at the highest level to our administration. And I yield to the gentlelady from Ohio, I will describe how the bill clearly provides that we can send as much money as Treasury wants, not to bail out American investors, but to bail out foreign investors. And when I say foreign investors, I don't just mean the companies here in the United States that happen to have foreign owners. I have sought at the Rules Committee to simply put an amendment in this bill to say that we're not going to buy any toxic asset that wasn't demonstrably owned by an American on September 20th. That amendment will not be allowed. It was not allowed last time. It won't be allowed this time. Why? Because they think they can hide from this Congress and from the American people the fact that hundreds of billions of dollars are going to overseas investors. And there are transparency provisions in the bill on a lot of things. But the one thing that will never be revealed, when Goldman Sachs sells a bond on December 1st to Treasury, that will what will not be revealed is whether Goldman Sachs bought it from the Bank of China 2 or 3 days earlier with intention to sell to Treasury. We are going to be buying bonds that are currently in vaults in Beijing and London. What Mr. Isaac also pointed out is that this bill is not going to solve the problem. People think that if you act in a panic and you throw $700 billion at something, you're going to solve it. Hardly. In his estimation, the credit markets will not be appreciably working any better than they are today. They may loosen things up for a week or two, but you're looking at a December that's no better than it would be if we did not pass this bill. The FDIC could solve this problem under their existing powers. If they're a little shy to use those powers to the hilt, we can and should pass a bill that outlines that, yes, indeed, we do want them to use their powers. What should they do? They should provide, for a temporary time, a total guarantee on all of the general credit debt of banks. So the regulated commercial banks would be places where people know their money is safe. They're subject to regulation, and the main part of this crisis is that the banks are unwilling to lend to each other, as they traditionally do, because no one bank is sure that the other bank is safe. We've got to say the commercial banks of America are safe and tell investors around the world that's where they can put their money with total safety. Now, this leaves out some Wall Street entities that are desperate for that $700 billion. They can just taste it. But it allows us to solve this problem without appreciable cost to U.S. taxpayer. And the FDIC collects an insurance premium from the banks, so it would be the financial system, not the American taxpayer, paying the cost of taking care of this risk. Now, I would hope that every member of Congress has received my blue paper. I've sent it out today via email. I've handed it out on the floor, but I know there are a few that haven't received it. Please contact my office and read. Learn how this bill will send half the money to foreign investors. Learn how this bill bails out firms that will continue to pay $1 million a month salaries and could pay and could raise those executives to $1.5 million a month should they choose to do so. Please read the paper, read about the key provisions of the bill, and then you'll be armed with the information necessary to deal with the fearmongers that tell you, well, you had to pass that bill. You had to dump $700 billion from a helicopter onto Wall Street because somehow that was going to take a terrible economy and turn it into a great economy. Such an action will indeed make things better for a few Wall Street executives. And they are very determined, and their employees on company time are calling our offices. The only way they can pass this bill is by creating and sustaining a panic atmosphere. That atmosphere is not justified. Many of us were told in private conversations that if we voted against this bill on Monday, that the sky would fall, the market would drop 2,000 or 3,000 points the first day, another couple thousand the second day, and a few members were even told that there would be martial law in America if we voted no. All fear-mongering. Unjustified, proven wrong. We've got a week, we've got 2 weeks to write a good bill. The only way to pass a bad bill, keep the panic pressure on. Now, what has the Senate done to this bill? First, they added pork to it in the hope that that would buy off some votes. Second, they've created a double hostage situation. Now, we already know that the first bill was a hostage situation. When Paulson announced this crisis, he basically sent a ransom note. And that ransom note read, we've got your 401k and you'll never see it alive again unless you send us $700 billion in unmarked bills. So we had one hostage situation. Now there's the AMT patch, a necessary tax provision that Congress passes every year. without this patch, the AMT tax, which is designed to fall only on the wealthy, will hit another 20 million American households. Everyone knows we have to pass this. We sent it to the Senate for them to pass. Instead of passing it, they created a hostage situation. They refused to pass it. They put it on this bill. And so now we're being told, if you don't send $700 billion to Wall Street, we're going to tax 20 million American families in a way no one in Congress wants to do. That's totally phony. If we don't vote down, if we vote down this bill, the Senate will pass the AMT patch bill that we sent them, just like they do every year. Now, there was some attempt to tell the American people that this bill isn't going to cost anything permanently, because in 2013, we're going to get the money back from the financial services industry. Nothing could be further from the truth. All the bill says is if the president has to send us a proposal to tax the financial services industry. Now, keep in mind, if the president has any good ideas in 2013, he'll send them to us, or she'll send them to us. If the president is only sending us revenue ideas because they have to send them, they don't want to send that proposal, well, then they're going to send it with a note saying, I'm required to give you this proposal, but I think it's a bad idea. Now, what do you think we're going to do with a presidential proposal that is disparaged by the president? And furthermore, it would be absolutely impossible, and contrary to the intent of the bill, and contrary to the logic of the bill, contrary to the statutory provisions of the bill, to construct a tax that hit only those companies that got bailed out. Instead, the tax is going to hit the entire financial services industry, and a proposal like that is highly unlikely to pass the House. And if it passed the House, if it goes over to the Senate, 41 senators could block it, and Wall Street will have enough money to hire 4,100 lobbyists. Now, why is it that we can't tax the individual companies that are bailed out on some sort of proportional basis? Well, first, many of those firms aren't going to exist in 2013. Second, we're not even keeping track of how much money we lost on the assets we buy from Goldman Sachs versus how much money we lose on the assets we buy from Citibank. We'll know how much we bought from each of them, but we might buy really toxic assets from one and only mildly troublesome assets from the other. We mix them together, then we sell them off, we suffer a loss. We don't know how to attribute that loss. How much are we going to tax Goldman Sachs? How much are we going to tax Citigroup? We'll never know how to tax those we bailed out. Now, some of these companies we're bailing out are just going to be shell companies, so you know they're going to disappear before 2013. And you know that a tax bill is going to hit similarly sized banks with the same rate of tax. The banks that got a big bailout, the banks that got a small bailout, the banks that didn't get a bailout, the banks that sold us kind of bad assets, the banks that sold us assets that turned out to be worthless. Such a controversial tax bill submitted under duress by a president is not going to pass his House, let alone pass the Senate, which can stop it with 41 votes. Wall Street gets their money now, and we get it back never. Now, as I said, hundreds of billions of dollars are going to be used to bail out foreign investors. That is why my amendment, which easily fixes that problem, has been rejected, because the White House demands that we bail out these foreign investors. That's what they want to do. That's what they promised the Saudi royal family. That's what they promised the Bank of China. Those promises will be honored with the tax money squeezed out of the American people. Now, they talk about executive compensation being controlled in this bill. Some controls on some bonuses being given to some departing executives. Great. But they allow $1 million a month salaries. And if some executive says, well, you know, you wanted to pay me a good bonus on top of my $1 million a month salary, and now the bonus formula is being changed a little bit, the company can say, you know, you're right. We wanted to give you more money. We'll raise your $1 million a month salary to $2 million a month. Now, if that qualifies as limits on the executive compensation of companies that need and get a bailout under this bill, please explain to me how that is. The fact is, look, Bill Gates is running a great company. He doesn't need a bailout. I hope he gets paid a whole lot. But if your company's been run into the ground, if you need a bailout, if you're part of the reason for this panic situation, Why do you need to pay over $1 million a year to any executive? That ought to be the limit. And, you know, frankly, it strikes me as a generous limit. Now, we're told that there's going to be oversight under this bill. There is a good Democratic-dominated board that's created. It is a critique board, not a control board. It is a board that will issue press releases and reports, but it cannot halt, it cannot reverse, it cannot delay any decision made by the Secretary of the Treasury, which brings up another thing. Why are we having Paulson run this thing? I thought he already had a job. Secretary of the Treasury ought to be a full-time job if we're in a period of unparalleled sky-is-falling economic crisis. Furthermore, he's temporary. He's leaving Washington in January. Why doesn't this bill provide for an administrator selected in a bipartisan way with bipartisan support who's willing to stick around for 2 or 3 years? Because this is a Paulson-Bush power grab. Paulson doesn't want somebody else to do it. He wants to be up in Wall Street handing out the money to the companies he likes, ignoring the phone calls from the firms he doesn't like. But the board is just a critique board. Paulson's power is undiminished, and we're having a part-time temporary employee run this because that's what Paulson really wants.
That was Congressman Brad Sherman of California speaking on the floor of the House on October 2nd about the Wall Street bailout bill passed last week. Of course, many people were interested to know which members had been threatened and by whom exactly. Austin radio host Alex Jones had Sherman on the show and asked him. Sherman replied that he hadn't received permission from his informants to reveal their identities, as collegial protocol required. He downplayed the threat aspect, portraying it as hyperbole. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. In his speech, Representative Sherman raised the issue of U.S. taxpayer dollars being used to bail out banks in other countries. This debacle is of historic proportions because banking, too, has become globalized. You may have heard about the entire country of Iceland going bankrupt recently. Max Kaiser is a former Wall Street stockbroker who now lives in Paris, from where he and his partner, Stacey Herbert, produce Truth About Markets, a program that airs on the community radio station Resonance FM in London. Max also writes on financial issues, most recently in the Huffington Post, and he's frequently interviewed as a financial commentator. He did a series of documentaries on finance for Al Jazeera English that proved to be prophetic. His style is humorous, but the content is serious. I'm going to play you a radio adaptation of one of his documentaries to introduce the international angle. This film was produced in August of 07 at the height of the boom in Iceland. The visuals are great, and you can see the films on YouTube. This is from one called Money Geyser.
Hello and welcome to People in Power. I'm Juliana Rufus. Financial markets around the world are booming. Across every class of assets, from housing to art to stocks and shares, prices are hitting all-time highs. Almost every week, a new record is set for mergers and acquisitions or buyouts. So just where is all this money coming from? It's a financial trick called the carry trade. Investors borrow money in a country with low interest rates like Japan or Switzerland and invest in higher-yielding currencies or assets. All this borrowed money drives up asset prices and creates huge flows of capital into countries like New Zealand and Iceland, where interest rates are high.